The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Hi, it's Dr. Joe Fallon. Welcome to Inside Medicine.
Welcome to Inside Medicine.
We have a phenomenal guest in place today, and that's going to be Dr. Josette Palmer Bradshaw. Josette is a family doctor with an excellent experience and one of the best-looking offices east of the Mississippi. She loves to make sure that things look good, sound good, and she is a superb physician in family practice. She's artistic. She has the best office up to date of any doctor around. And I'm happy to say that she has been practicing a long time, highly, highly efficacious, and just a fantastic guest. Josette, are you hanging on there?
Good morning. Yes, I am. And your words were far too kind, Dr. Fallon. I didn't even pay you yet.
Well, don't give anybody the idea. We appreciate your artistic flair. So how long have you been in family practice, Josette? Because you've been a stellar performer in the South Jersey marketplace, and you're as good as anybody east or west of the Delaware River.
Well, I hate to say it, but it's been 28 years. I graduated residency in 96. So I've been 28 years in South Jersey practicing medicine.
And you do a great job, and your patients love you. And I just have to ask you, before we get to the medical part of the show, how did you get this artistic flair?
I don't know. Probably from hanging out with docs like yourself.
I don't think so. My wife would say no. All right. Well, as long as we're going to be kidding around, let's just get to the heart of things. So someone has a tick bite in South Jersey or in Philadelphia. Do they need to get antibiotics? Because I think they come knocking at your door and say, Josette, give me an antibiotic.
Yes, that usually what happens. They call up as soon as they get bit by the tick and they want meds right away. There are, you know, in some cases, they'll, you know, I'll give them a week's worth of doxycycline, but really, they can wait a couple of weeks and get the blood work done. It does take 2 to 3 weeks for the blood work to be positive. But if they do get a rash, that lovely bullseye rash, there's nothing, that is the only thing that'll pretty much cause that. So if they do call and they say they got bit by a tick or they have a bullseye rash, then I will go ahead and give them the antibiotics. But if they don't get the antibiotics, I would at least want them to get the blood work done if they know they've been bitten by a tick, because that way we can check for Lyme disease. And this summer has definitely been a busy summer for the ticks. There have been plenty out there, and I must admit I've had my fair share of tick bites myself. So if anybody's out there out walking their dog, or they're just out spending a lot of time in the yard, they fall down from the trees, they're in the grass. So it's definitely important to check yourself, your children, your animals when you come in from outside, and reach out to your primary care provider in order to get blood work done. And if you get a bullseye, then you definitely want to get that and get the antibiotics on board. Because if you get a bullseye on your skin, then that is Lyme disease until proven otherwise.
So let me ask you this. One trick that I heard from probably you in the past, because you've been on the show two other times, do ticks hang out in the center of the lawn, or do they hang out on the side of the lawn where everybody has their plants?
So I'm not as sure about that. I mean, I know from my own personal experience, they're definitely on the edges, and I've been, you know, a victim of them falling out the trees. So
gotcha.
I just think it's important to definitely check, and you can actually spray. There are companies out there that will spray, and that can help prevent the ticks.
Got it. So the edges are really the problem area. So that's just a very important point. And you can spray and you can get companies to come in and make sure that you're tick-free. Let me ask you this, because you're in the family practice business. A lot of people want to travel in the summertime, and I think it's still going to be heating up this time of the year. How often do you need to get patients' vaccines for travel? And is it worthwhile getting it?
Well, for the regular trips that we're going, you're traveling abroad, you always want to make, even local, you want to make sure that you have your tetanus is up to date. It's not that, you know, you can be traveling, you slip, you fall. You don't want to have to go to get to the infirmary or go somewhere just to get a tetanus shot. When that's something you can, you know, have here at home, and you want to make sure you get that every 10 years. Hepatitis A series, you definitely want to make sure that's up to date, especially if you're going on a cruise, you're traveling to different places where the water is not like our water here in the U.S. You definitely want to make sure you have your Hep A shots. Now, if you're going on a safari, well, that's a different animal. You definitely have to make sure that you check with those authorities there to see what is required, because a lot of times you're going in a travel group and they will say you need, maybe you need yellow fever. Maybe you need prophylaxis for malaria. But you know, the basic ones is make sure your tetanus is up to date, and I would definitely have your hepatitis A series under your belt. And a lot of times, like with hepatitis A, once you get it, you're done. You get your two shots. They're given 6 months apart. Once you receive those vaccines, it's not like the tetanus where you need to get that every 10 years.
Yeah, and I should point out that the Rowan Internal Medicine has a specialist if you're traveling long distances around the world, because there's many requirements that the State Department requests, and you can get that by calling infectious disease at Rowan University. A definite plus. So your opinion is that vaccines are important when someone's traveling.
Yes, I believe in vaccines anyway, so definitely when you travel.
Okay, so how about another complaint that I'm sure you get in your office? How about the famous skin rashes of poison ivy?
Yes, poison ivy is very common this time of year, especially in the spring when people are cleaning up their yards. They want them to look nice and pretty, but yet they are not really sure what's in their yard or what's on the edge of their yard. And they call up because they got this rash, it's bubbling up, it's red, very itchy. Some are familiar. I used to have a patient that every spring he was calling because he had poison ivy. Poison ivy is very itchy, common on the arms, sometimes on, you know, also on the neck, areas that are usually exposed. But I've even had patients who, they were living in an area where someone on their street was burning poison ivy. And that, it carries in the air. And it's the oil. And once that oil gets on your skin, now not everyone is sensitive to poison ivy. So someone can come in contact with it. They can cut it down. They cannot wear gloves, which I wouldn't advise. And they can be in contact with it and they don't even break out. But then there's others who they can just smell it. And next thing you know, they're itching. And a lot of people aren't familiar with the rash. Might be poison ivy, poison sumac, poison oak. Those are very different plants, but they cause a very similar reaction on the body. And with the poison ivy, sumac, any of those allergic kind of the contact dermatitis is from plants, steroids are in order. You don't want to have to take courses of steroids a lot throughout your lifetime, but steroids are given orally, and there's even topical steroids. Poison ivy is very oily. The rash itself oozes, and I've seen it can get very messy. And sometimes you can even get a bacterial infection even on top of it. The more you scratch, the more it itches. So poison ivy is definitely one of the things we see in the summertime a lot of.
So, Josette, let me just ask you, what I've seen is just can flip a doctor out is when it gets close to the eye. If you have a patient with poison ivy or poison oak or whatever, and it gets close to the eye, is there anything special you would do? So would you tank them up with a steroid to try and prevent further, or is that a mistake?
Well, an oral steroid, I'm giving them an oral steroid anyway. But when things get too close to the eye like that, I would have them see the ophthalmologist. I wouldn't. That's not something I would still treat them. But if it's getting in the eye or too close to right, of course, because when we sweat, we rub. It's not uncommon. We'll sweat. We'll rub our eyes because our eyes sweat, and then it can get in the eye or near the eye. So I would advise them to see their eye doctor, their ophthalmologist. And if they don't have one, I would refer them out.
Okay. And do you see much sunburn in your practice?
I do. Not as often as I used to. I think people are getting a little bit smarter, but you know, they go out in the sun. They're not even familiar with what it is. And they don't realize, they come in and they realize that they're very hot, their skin is irritated, it's red. It's not oozy like poison ivy, where poison ivy, you have distinct bubbles and it oozes. But I have had patients with sunburn where it'll bubble up, and it actually can be a burn, like a first degree, a second degree, even like a third degree burn from sunburn, especially someone that has sensitive skin. I've had a patient that got a tattoo, and they didn't follow the proper instructions, and they went and they laid out at the beach on their back, and their tattoo, they got sunburn on their back. And it actually did bubble up, and they needed antibiotics, they needed steroids. So it's not something to be taken lightly. Sunburn can be painful. Also the lips are common. You know, it's very important to use sunscreen, and I think sometimes it gets overlooked. But, you know, more and more patients are using sunscreen, and, you know, they even have sunscreen that's good enough for the little people to use, the infants, the toddlers. So we can't forget about them. And once you go in the water, then you want to make sure you reapply it after so often. It's not apply early in the morning and forget about it the rest of the day.
Fantastic. So anybody can really get that sunburn. And just that brings up a topic to me. Because a lot of people, the minute they get sunburn, they want a steroid. Can you give me your kickback if a patient says, "I need it. I have a little sunburn and I need a steroid"? How do you answer that question to the patient, because they're desperate for prednisone?
Yeah, I think they want help, and I get that. And they're uncomfortable, and because it is painful, it's not as much of needing a steroid. I've had success with burn cream, actually, the Silvadine on the skin for that, maybe a topical, but I'm more concerned about them getting an infection, not necessarily using the steroid. We're kind of going away from using a lot of steroids, even for, like, respiratory infections. They don't want to keep using steroids over and over again. So you have to kind of keep in mind, you know, what we're dealing with, and just more education. And I do realize a lot of patients don't want to be educated. I mean, they come in and they ask for what they want, and they can be demanding. And sometimes you spend a lot more time trying to educate them and to what they should have, and not necessarily always giving them what they want.
So Gisette, you just gave a tip off why people love you so much. Congratulations. Let me just move forward just a little bit. So someone comes to your office and why does my foot hurt, doctor, when I get out of bed in the morning? When you get that particular history, what goes through your mind, differential diagnosis, et cetera?
Well, first I want to know, where is it bothering them at? Is it their front of their foot? Is it their toes? Is it their big toe? Is it their heel? If it's their big toe, the top of my list is gout, but I don't want people to think that gout is just in the big toe, because gout can be in the big toe, it can be in the ankle, it can be in the knee, it can be in the wrist. So gout can be in different areas of the body. That would be one of the more common ones. And, you know, I'd ask them, when did it start? I asked them about their diet. Because a lot of times gout is diet, it derives from the diet. What kind of foods have they been eating? It's summertime. There's a lot of barbecues. There's a lot of parties. There's a lot, you know, sometimes we indulge in alcohol. We indulge in a lot of hot dogs and, you know, a lot of the good stuff. So steaks, shellfish. So a lot of those things can be, they put up a little red, like a little signal that maybe, you know, diet could be involved to the BGAL. And that's without even checking any lab work. I would like in my patients to complain of foot pain in their big toe, even if they don't have a history of gout. You know, let's come in, get some blood work done. I'm going to get a uric acid level, because gout is when the uric acid crystals spill out into the joint. And that's, we can measure the uric acid level in the blood. And it's not necessarily a uric acid level that's, it might not be high. It might not be over, you know, over six. But if it's different than what it was before, especially if it's someone who has gout in the past, if their diet changes, it can, you can get a gout attack even from your uric acid level going lower than what it's been. So I would definitely do a history. A lot of times in family medicine, it's all about the history. It's not, you know, it's about the physical exam, and it's, you know, the lab test. But the bulk of where I'm going to get my information is the history. If it's their heel that's bothering them, then I'm going down the path of plantar fasciitis or heel spur syndrome. And sometimes it's a matter of, well, what kind of work do you do? Are you sitting? Are you standing? What kind of shoes do you wear when you're working? What kind of support do you have? Sometimes I have patients that they don't have an arch, and that changes how they walk. So they tend to be more susceptible to plantar fasciitis. And when I say heel spur, and they say, well, what's that mean? And, you know, is it a growth? And it doesn't necessarily start out like that. Plantar fasciitis is inflammation of the Achilles tendon, and the Achilles tendon lands on the bottom of your foot in the, where your heel is. But over time, as that continues, then there is an actual bony growth that they can pick up on an x-ray. So I would review stretching, give them an anti-inflammatory. So the treatment, you know, once you find out what it is, treatment for gout is different than the treatment for plantar fasciitis or heel spur. Both could involve an anti-inflammatory, but gout, depending on what the uric acid is, that might involve medication to help lower the uric acid level.
Got it. So when somebody presents with that foot, do you have a different approach if they're diabetic?
Well, yes, because with diabetes, we have to worry about circulation. We have to worry about the nervous system. Could it be that they're developing neuropathy? And it's again, that's where education comes into play, because I've had patients who their diabetes is doing well, they're controlled, their A1C is where it needs to be, but yet they're starting to develop neuropathy. So then we go through, well, you know, you have had diabetes for a while. And, you know, diabetes is a long-term disease we have to manage. So that can be one of the things that happen. And with that, that's a different story, because that's more of a burning or a tingling in the bottom of the feet. It can go up to like a sock distribution where it'll be up above the ankle. So now to look into that, then I would order, if they haven't had their A1C done and their blood sugar done, I would order, you know, the basic labs, the hemoglobin A1C and a comprehensive metabolic panel. And I would order thyroid, and I would order B12, but they should have an EMG done. So, and that's treated differently, because an anti-inflammatory isn't going to do much for diabetic neuropathy, but there are some medications out there that address the nerve problem, and that can treat that appropriately.
So what can happen is in long-term diabetes, especially far from the heart, that tissue is more prone to be infected, inflamed, et cetera. So, so you were talking about neuropathy. That just means, like, if you use your tuning fork on them, they can't feel it. The tuning fork's still going when they tap your lateral malleolus and they can't feel it. That means, you know, that they have a bit of a neuropathy and they need to maybe get a consultation on that with somebody in that business. What about vascular stuff in diabetes? I'm just curious if you run into that.
I do. Not as much. I say in this day and age, no patient with diabetes should lose a limb, a toe, for the treatment, because if they're going to, if they're seeing a provider and they're taking their medication, there's no, if they, they need, I think a big of it, a lot of it is communication. We have to check the feet. We have to warn the diabetics about walking barefoot. I had a friend of mine, she's diabetic. She stepped on something, got a splinter in her foot just last weekend. And she's like, I know. I shouldn't be walking barefoot. That's a big no-no with diabetes, because diabetics cannot always feel when they step on something. And oftentimes, I had a patient who, when I was in residency, she stepped on a toothpick, and she didn't know she stepped on a toothpick until she stepped on the other toothpick, because she was using toothpicks every night after dinner to work, get her food out of her teeth, but not really paying attention to where the toothpicks were ending up at night. And she ended up having to have general surgery to get the toothpick out. So you definitely want to check the circulation. That's where an arterial Doppler would come into play. It doesn't take much for me to want to order something like that. Diabetics are really prone to vascular disease. They are to be treated as if they are someone that already has had a heart attack. That's why it's important for them to be on cholesterol medication, but they don't quite understand why, if their cholesterol is normal, but cholesterol medication can do more for than just lower the cholesterol. So it is important to check the circulation, and we do warn them about walking barefoot, ask them to check their feet. They should check their feet daily, and they should see a podiatrist. Now, does it happen with all diabetics? No, it does not, but that's what they should be doing.
Yeah, Josette, I just want to put one thing in. I mean, people, the average American has a bad cholesterol of about 135. But if you get your bad cholesterol down to 74, you get a 40-45% reduction in MI, stroke, and death. And, of course, that will help those that foot circulation, too. So, again, you know, there's a normal range, but basically the doctors are teaching, hey, look, normal ain't good enough anymore, especially if you're diabetic. You want to get that LDL to 74.
Correct.
So let me ask about something like that. Do you get much toe fungus issues? You're in family practice. You've been around the horn. Much with toenail fungus?
No, not that much. I think in the last year, I don't think I've seen five. But again, I mean, I tell patients, the time to come in for that, if you want your toes to look good in the summer, you definitely want to come in earlier in the year, because the toenail is very slow growing. And even if we treat it with the antifungal medication, and which is oftentimes a pill, there are some topical stuff out there, that's nothing that's going to get better in a couple months. You got to be in that for the long haul, for 9 months, 12 months, even sometimes 18 if you're looking for it to grow out on its own. So I don't see as much toenail fungus, don't see as much even the fungal infections of the foot as much. I mean, I'm not sure why, but that's actually an interesting thought now that I think about it. Yeah, I'm not seeing as much toenail fungus. And if you do treat that, then you have to worry about their liver function test, because the oral medications are processed by the liver. So I advise my patients to have their blood work done ahead of time, and then also I repeat the labs after they complete treatment.
So just before we get off the foot, I just want to ask you one other question. What do you think about plantar fasciitis?
In regards to... just in general?
Do you see it often? Do you have to treat that often in your practice?
That's probably the most common out of the things that we discussed. That's probably the most common that I see. I do think it's important to stretch. Everybody wants a quick fix. So it's, you know, give me a pill. Let me have a shot. But the big thing is stretching. You know, I've had patients come and they come in for their annual, and I say, anything else going on? I give them the options, you know, what other things you need to discuss. And I had a patient just came in within the last month, who a year ago when they came in for their annual, they were having an issue with plantar fasciitis. We went over stretching. I showed them some stretches. I discussed, you know, taking an anti-inflammatory. We talked about heel inserts. You can even, I know you used to, I don't know if you still can, Walmart has an apparatus there where they can fit you for a heel insert. You can go to podiatry and they can fit you. It's a little different, a little more expensive than Walmart. But within a year, that patient came back. And the only thing he did the stretching. You know, he did the stretching that I recommended. He didn't even get the inserts. He didn't go to physical therapy. I have sent patients to physical therapy for plantar fasciitis. But, you know, the stretching seemed to help. Stretching is important anyway for the Achilles, especially if you have someone that's active. Because that's another thing that I've seen a few of, torn Achilles tendon. Someone playing basketball, they tore their Achilles tendon. Matter of fact, every torn Achilles tendon that I've taken care of, it's been patients that were playing basketball. So stretching is very important, stretching and hydration.
All right, Josette, I love it. So let me just move on a second here. It's the summertime, and if a patient comes to you and says, I'm so hot, I feel like I'm going to pass out, maybe over the phone. Should I be concerned, doctor? Do you ever get that one? I'm so hot, I feel like I'm going to pass out.
With this being in the summertime, oftentimes patients get overheated. It's always good to know, like, what are their medical problems they have? Are they diabetic? Do they have hypertension? Do they have a history of heart disease? Is it that they're dehydrated? That's your first go-to, you know, is dehydration. Are you making sure that you're drinking enough? And that's one of the advantages of family medicine is knowing your patient and then being able to figure out what other things might be going on. Oftentimes, if it sounds like they were going to pass out or they didn't pass out, but they got really dizzy or lightheaded, or I do want them to be seen. I don't necessarily send them to the emergency room. I try to get them in the office, and then I can evaluate them, get more of the story, find out what they were doing, what they did that day, did they eat, did they drink, what kind of activities were they doing, were they outside a lot, I'll do some blood work. Hydration is important, and it's often underscored. I've had quite a few patients in the last month or so go to the emergency room with dehydration, you know, and I'm looking at some of the numbers, and they are a little dehydrated. I don't think sometimes patients don't really realize how important it is to stay hydrated. But then I'm also cautious because when you say, okay, I want you to drink more water, you know, it isn't a bad idea to throw in some electrolytes, but I don't want them drinking Gatorade all day long because that's not good either. But, you know, in the course of your day, if you're outside a lot, you're getting overheated, you're in the heat, you're not in cool air, then you do want to make sure that that you do throw some electrolytes in there. But then could it be a cardiac issue? Were they having palpitations? Were they short of breath? I've seen a lot more atrial fibrillation. Was their heart rate up? Were their heart rate down? Were they bradycardic? I mean, that's another thing that you have to do. So then I'll do an EKG. So I'll do labs. I'll do an EKG. Is a person that has asthma or COPD, you know, I could do a pulmonary function test. Are they not using their inhaler? It's something where patients will, I feel good, so I'm not going to take my medicine. And then especially with a lung condition, that's one of the worst things you can do because unless you have a real good idea, you as the patient, as to what's going on with your body, you could be, your asthmatics are good for, oh, I didn't need that. And then they come into me and they say, yeah, I've been coughing and I was really hot and I was having some trouble breathing. And they'll grab their rescue inhaler. And then I say, well, you're grabbing your rescue inhaler. How many times a day are you using your rescue inhaler? Well, you know, 3 times a day, 4 times a day, twice a day, every day. They need to be on their maintenance inhaler. So it's important to get the history. And sometimes it's hard to tease that information from patients because patient doesn't know what's important. A patient only, they might know how they feel at the moment, but they're not thinking, well, how did they feel when they were walking up that hill at the 4-H fair? Or how do they feel when they, at night when they were asleep and they didn't have air, something, their air conditioner, the AC broke, and now they're getting winded and they don't realize, well, all that stuff is important. So yes, you're here in the office and I'm talking to you and you said, yeah, I was feeling a little lightheaded, but what else goes along with that story? So again, it's just so important, you know, to hear the story. And if they're older, what about their carotids? When's the last time, you know, did they ever have a carotid Doppler done? Because that can make you lightheaded or dizzy if there's a blockage in the main arteries in your neck. So again, patients don't know that one thing can be connected to a lot of different disease processes. So you got to ask the questions.
So, Josette, I got to also point out this time of the year, the heat. A lot of people are trying to save on bucks and they cut their air conditioner off. And if the temperature gets so hot, I mean, people can just do the old faint out. So just hopefully everybody knows, keep the air conditioner on if you're older. Make sure that you've got the water that you're recommending that can have some Gatorade in it too. But let's just make sure everybody stays hydrated so they don't end up in the ER with a need to get hospitalized for IV and IV fluids. Josette, let me just move ahead a second. The patient says, I feel hot. Am I going to pass out? Should I be concerned? Do you get that phone call to your office?
Yes, that's the one. Yep, that's the one we just went over. Yes, I do. Patients often call in, and it's best to call. I mean, I appreciate them calling in. I want them to call us first. I don't want them to just go to the emergency room and or urgent care. But yes, they call in with that oftentimes. And we have had some patients that they have passed out. And, you know, it could be a cardiac, it would require a cardiac workup. It could be a neurological condition that could be causing it. So there's a lot of different things. So passing out is something that I would not ignore. Oftentimes, sometimes we don't always find out the reason. You know, their labs look good. Their EKG, the Holter monitor, the cardiac workup is negative. The neurological workup is negative. But, you know, we might not find out the reason, but I definitely would not ignore it. I definitely would work it up.
Fantastic. So let me just switch gears. Headache is a common complaint to the family doctor. That's what I'm told. How does a family doctor decide whether it's a tension headache, whether it's a sinus headache, or whether it's a migraine? Because the differential diagnosis is a little wide here.
Yes, it is. It is. Those are the more common ones. Tension, more so, they complain of like a band feeling around their head that feels tight. Oftentimes is affiliated with increased stress. When they're in for an exam, oftentimes their neck muscles will feel tight because the muscles for the neck, they actually insert in the back of the head. So all of that can be related. So again, it's all about getting the history. Sinus headache, what other things are going on? Do they have any upper respiratory symptoms? Fever, congestion, sore throat. A very common one is teeth pain. I've had quite a few patients go to the dentist because they think they're having a bad tooth. And a dentist kicks them out of their chair and says, you got to go see your primary. You got a sinus infection. So often, you know, I ask, when you lean over, you feel the pressure in their face. And they don't even realize it. They say, yeah, you're right. Every time I go to put my shoes on, my head hurts. I get dizzy. So a lot of times that can cause the headache. And it's treated different. You know, and with a migraine, that one is usually can be a severe pain. Not the worst headache ever, but it could be severe pain where it's like a throbbing. It's usually one-sided. Oftentimes confused with a sinus headache because the nerves are innervated. Your head is not a lot of area there, but there's a lot of nerves working. So then that can actually be confused with like a sinus headache. So often when they get a sinus migraine, they might get some nasal congestion. They often want to go into a dark room. What makes it better? Because oftentimes patients are, you know, when it's headaches, they're trying things. They've done things so that they can treat it so they can feel better. And they've done that before they come in to see me. So I'll say, well, what makes it feel better? Does anything make it feel better? Well, if I go take a nap, I say, well, what if that happens if you turn the lights on? If the lights bother you? Oh, yeah, the lights bother me. What about noise? Does noise bother you? Oh, most definitely, yeah. And I can't stand to be around loud noises when I'm having these headaches. So those are things you often see with migraines. Sometimes you get a warning, you know, from the migraine. They might get like flashes of light. They might see floaters. That, you know, that's an aura. They might get like a warning, letting them know this headache's coming. For women, especially around the cycles, they might get migraines. They can be worse that during that time. In the summer, with the humidity, definitely see more migraines. Maybe with storms, we've had some thunder boomers around in the area in the last few weeks. We noticed it then. I had patients complaining. Yeah, when that storm came, I was, you know, I really felt the felt the difference in my head. Another one, I had one patient who their trigger was food. She thought that eating a pound of bacon every other day was okay. And once she changed her diet. She didn't have any other issues in regards to the migraine. So a lot of it is getting the story, and there is medication you can give to prevent the migraines. And once we get the prevention meds on board, then they're not getting the headaches as often. So that's also a beautiful thing.
Beautiful thing I love. So now we're going to switch, Josette, if I can, to a very to-date, up-to-date issue. So a patient shows up and says, are any of those weight loss drugs good for me? Those GLP-1s that all the actresses and actors out in California use, do people really come to you and say, I'm not a diabetic, but I want to lose weight. Do you have anything you can give me, doc?
So earlier in the year, it was madness and mayhem in the office. People were calling every day, all day. I guess it blew. I'm not one who's on social media a lot, and it just blew up. Everybody was coming in, and not everybody, but a large number of people were calling up or coming in and asking for Ozempic or Mounjaro. And I said, well, you're not diabetic. Well, I don't know. So it's a shame because they see stuff on social media and they don't understand the difference. Now, those same drugs, Ozempic and Mounjaro, have equivalents that can be used for weight loss. Same product, but it's different name, Wegovy and Zepbound. And so then again, you got to educate. But they don't want to hear that. They want what they want when they want it, and they want that shot. And so you go over the side effects. Some people come in, and they don't even realize it's a shot. And one of my patients, she was a nurse. And she said, well, it's a needle? I don't want that. So it's a shame because it's all about education. You got to talk about the side effects. And they're not innocuous. They have some GI side effects. So some patients get nauseous. Even I've used it for diabetes, but the diabetics can have some side effects from it. That's why they start low with the dosing and you gradually increase it. I'm not against using it. I've used the Wegovy and the Zepbound for patients for weight loss. The problem that we're running into, the big problem, is coverage. And they're not cheap. And so I tell patients, you get smarter the longer you do some of these things. I have the patients, you call your insurance company and you find out from them what's covered. Because when we send the prescription, then we have to do the prior auth. But it's a knee-jerk reaction. The prior auth comes whether the drug is covered or not, and so that's staff time wasted. I was at on a call with other family medicine docs with an insurance company, and they were all talking about how inundated they were with calls when this kind of erupted earlier in the year. It's definitely better now. But I know in this time, in the last few months, we've gotten new patients into practice who they really only wanted to lose weight. And that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to help the patient. But I have patients that they just want the shot. They don't want to diet. They don't want to exercise. They don't want to talk to a nutritionist. And I have a nutritionist that comes to the office one day a week. And I'm like, you know, if you're, I'm sure your insurance will cover it. They outright said no. So again, getting smarter, you know, trying to push the patients a little bit more to get the necessary dietary help. One thing that I have noticed, and that those medications, the GLP-1s, as a patient describes it to me, they turn that noise off in their brain. So that noise that says, let's go have a second helping, let's go into the kitchen, it's 11 o'clock at night, you know, you want a snack, it turns that noise off. You know, some patients are on, I have patients who are on the maximum doses for some of these medications. I discourage that. As you're losing weight, I tell them, you know, stay where you're at, and then once you reach a plateau, then bump it up. Because at some point, I mean, I don't envision patients having to be on these meds forever. A diabetic, yes, that's one thing, that's different. But if I've had diabetics who they've lost weight on these medications, and if they lose the weight and their numbers come down, they're looking good, then I try to bring it down a little bit because less is better. I think in medicine, you give more and more and more and more and more, and it's not necessarily in the best interest of the patients all the time.
So, Jose, let me just make a clarification. So, Ozempic and Mounjaro are for diabetes, and Wegovy and Zepbound are for weight. And the definition of weight for the insurance companies is a BMI over 30. So a lot of people come in and they have a BMI of 26, and you just have to tell them you just can't get a weight loss drug for a BMI of 26. You have to be over 30. And it's not at 30, it's over 30. So it's very important for people to know, check your BMI before you come to the doctor, because if your BMI is not over 30, it's going to be very hard to get that drug for you, even if you have a gold pattern insurance company.
Correct. And you know, the thing is that patients will come in, and I can count on my one hand, you came in the last 6 months, but I just need to lose 10 pounds, doc. I just need to lose 10 pounds. Can you just give me something so I can lose 10 pounds? And I think we're so fixated on weight that we're losing sight of what it is to be healthy. And being thinner doesn't necessarily make you healthy. If you're not exercising, being active is important, because we want to increase the activity, because that'll help the whole cardiovascular picture. But you're right. I mean, that's what the insurance companies see as being obese. That's different than what patients are seeing. And I'm a little nervous of what's going to happen, because now I believe Medicare is approving of these medications, and that's going to cause more of an issue. But I don't think it's going to bring the price down. At the end of the day, it's still prices.
I think you're right about that. So let's move on, because that's a hot topic that there's not much more we can say. Ozempic and Mounjaro for diabetes, Wegovy and Zepbound for overweight, BMIs over 30. So Josette, let me just move a second. I had a cold a month ago, but I'm still coughing. What could it be?
Seeing a lot of few different viral infections come up this year. Every week, I'm still coughing. And it's not even a secondary bacterial infection. You do a chest x-ray, they don't have pneumonia. But I've seen a lot of rhinovirus this year. I actually believe I saw more rhinovirus than I did COVID since the beginning of the year. And I do a respiratory swab that I love, because it checks for about 20 different infections. And rhinovirus was the winner. And it tends to settle in the chest. And even though, you know, in different strains, it's just like the common cold, but it's not going away. And it settles in the chest, and oftentimes steroid inhaler will help treat that cough, but that cough is lasting a couple months. Patients get nervous. Do I have pneumonia? Do I need more antibiotics? Do I need antibiotics? So I'll order a chest x-ray. I'll do a pulmonary function test, and the pulmonary function test isn't always normal. And it does show that when with doing the two-part test, that they'll benefit from some bronchodilation. So then I'll give them an albuterol inhaler. There's even a newer inhaler out that has an albuterol in it and a steroid in it, and that's been helpful. But it is something, even like the benzonate, the Tessalon pearls, that can help treat the cough. But oftentimes, it's not an actual infection. It's a result of the viral infection, but they don't have a bacterial infection. They don't have a pneumonia, but they do have this cough that lingers on. You know, if they have a history, if they're a smoker, there is some concern. Are they developing COPD? Because there's plenty of smokers out there that they haven't been diagnosed with COPD as of yet. Or is it something we need to worry about? Is it early lung cancer? I mean, you don't want to think the worst, but, you know, someone who's a smoker, they're definitely a setup for that. So by all means, yes, it does need to be worked up. But it's something that we're seeing a lot of. And it's kind of funny because I tell the patient, yeah, that cough is going to last about 2 months. And then when they come back in, they'll say, yeah, doc, you were right, 2 months. I mean, yeah, because it's what we've seen. And I've seen it a lot since the early part of the year. And it is kind of resurging again, seeing it again. And also now in the last couple of weeks, I had quite a few people call with positive COVID tests. So that's also happening. I don't know if it's because they're traveling or what, but definitely starting to see a little bit more COVID too.
Yeah, there is a new COVID variant out on the market, and I've seen patients with it. So got to gear up for COVID again. Joseph, right. Let me just ask you something. Is it too early to get a flu shot?
Yes, it is. So when you go to pick up your prescription refill and they say they want to shoot you with your flu shot in August, I would politely decline. The best time to get it, the earliest I would get the flu shot would be September. We really need the flu shot to last until the early spring. So, and it usually flu season starts around December as far as when the virus is in the area. It can rear its ugly head a little earlier, and the last year it was a little early, but August is a little early to get the flu shot. Pharmacies will start offering it out to patients in August. That's usually when they offer it out. A lot of my patients get theirs here in the office because we do give it out here, and they just feel more comfortable getting it from us. But it is kind of early to get their flu shot, but I would definitely get it. So I would not wait until January. Have I given flu shots out in January? Yes. I've had patients who... They just, for some reason, life got away from them, and they're in January for their annual, and, you know, they say, you know, I didn't get a flu shot. Can I still get one? Yes, I would still give a flu shot out. The latest that I gave a flu shot out was maybe March, but, you know, it doesn't have much value in March, not as much as if they would have got it in December or November. But it still provides some protection, and it does take a couple of weeks for the vaccine to work. So once they get the flu shot, we still have, you know, a couple of weeks we need to wait in order for it to be effective.
So really, in the New Jersey, Philadelphia marketplace, generally November 15th, I see is the recommended time to get it before that, but not too sooner, because you want that durability of that vaccine. So
exactly.
Just move forward here. So you have, I don't know if you have, I think your girls are older, but I have a teenager going to college this month. What kind of shots do I need to go before I say goodbye to mom?
So this is the time where we're sending our college kids off to school, and you definitely want to make sure. Now, not all colleges have this requirement. They should. But not all colleges have the requirement, but the majority, the ones that are up to date, they're requiring meningitis B shots. So that may be Bexsero, that may be Trumemba. The meningitis B shots are what we definitely recommend. It's not required for the state for high school or for junior high, whereas at age 11, they're required to get a different meningitis shot, the meningitis ACYW35. So that's given at age 11 when they get their pertussis, their tetanus with the pertussis. the Tdap. That's done at 11. So that's where they get their first one, their first meningitis. But then the partner to that one, that second one, is usually given around like the 16-year-old well visit. So in the perfect world, young people are still coming in once a year for their annuals, and that's when we can update their shot record. I will update a shot record even at a sick visit. If they don't have a fever and they're behind in their shots, then they're going to get offered a vaccine. They might be sick. Their parents might not want them to have it. They might not want it. But if they're game, then they're getting their vaccine record updated, because they'll get their.
I just want to jump in. We're getting close to the end. So we have a story here. Say your mother broke a bone. Does that mean that I'm, as a female, going to have weak bones?
Not necessarily, but you definitely want to get that checked. If you're menopausal, you've been more than 2 years without a period, then they should start getting DEXA scans done. So weak bones is more so osteopenia, osteoporosis. If a person or woman has osteoporosis, then there's definitely treatments out there that will help rebuild bone. But it's not arthritis. So arthritis is a different animal. That's more of degeneration, and that's where you get deposits on your joints. But osteoporosis is thinning of the bone, and that's what makes you more susceptible to a broken bone.
So osteoporosis, they have a definite guideline, minus 2.5, your osteoporotic. Osteopenia can be less than that, 2.5. But a lot of the girls, especially menopausal, should get a baseline DEXA, and then 2 years later get a follow-up just to see what their bone loss is. Because it's how much bone you lose per time.
Yep, and insurance will cover that test every 2 years. Mammogram every year, DEXA every two.
Got it. And what about allergy shots? You've already talked about that, so I just want to move on. What about somebody who comes in and says, I've got to fix this noise in my ear?
So oftentimes that's tinnitus or tinnitus, however you would like to say it. That's a ringing or a humming in the ear. It can be very difficult to treat, but it does warrant an evaluation of the hearing. Also, it could be related to their allergies. It could be related to a sinus infection. But it's definitely, you know, I would do an exam. Sometimes I have a patient with wax in their ears, so that needs to be cleared out. But if everything, all things being equal, and everything is normal, the exam is fine, they need to get to the ear, nose, and throat so they can evaluate them. They'll order a hearing eval. They'll do it there in the office. But it's often difficult to treat. I know with some of these newer hearing aids, they can actually help the ringing in the ear. But often patients are annoyed with it, and because it is difficult and there is no definitive treatment, that'll just make it go away forever.
So, Josette, you have a shindig coming on in your office, because you're always very artistic. Tell me what you have coming around the corner at your office.
We do. September 15th. We are having our annual open house. Ever since I opened the practice, we have done an open house as more of a let patients know this is where we are, and it's more of a community give back. We have a health fair. We do screenings, vision screenings, hearing screenings, carotid Doppler screenings, blood pressure checks, cholesterol. We have plenty of giveaways. We have door prizes. We raffle off baskets, and with the money that we raise from the raffle, we use that to help needy families in the Glassboro area. So everyone is invited. You don't have to be a patient to attend. We have a petting zoo for the little ones. We have face painting. We do a lot. And then also this year, I believe we have the Washington Township, the fire and police will also be out. So it's a big community give back. My staff, it's a lot of work, but we enjoy doing it.
Josette, so tell people how to get in touch with you if they want to make a visit.
Happy Healthy You Family Medicine, 856-881-5111. We are in Turnersville, New Jersey, and my staff and myself love doing what we do. Thank you very much.
Josette, you're fantastic, one of the best in the business, and thank you for being on Inside Medicine. Your podcast will be up in approximately an hour. Thank you very much for listening to Inside Medicine. We will be back next week. Thanks for listening in, and check out Josette's podcast. Amen. Catch you guys next week. Joe Fallon signing off.
battles aren't won solely on the field. That's a common misconception. Battles are won within, over enemies of fear, enemies of doubt. In that place where promises are kept. Promises to oneself.
This is a physical training event.
Promises to one's community.
Healthy people move debris out of their house.
Promises to one's country. In the heart of every Marine, you'll find a promise. A promise forever kept. A promise of battles won.